everyone. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. This morning, as we've done every Friday for most of the last year, we continue our series, The Lines Between Us. We've examined inequality as it pertains to housing and employment and the criminal justice system and other areas. Later in this hour, Sheila will have a conversation about poverty in the suburbs. Now, a conversation about privilege and the subtle and not-so-subtle ways in which race, gender, and class contribute to it. In 1988, a women's studies scholar from Wellesley College named Peggy McIntosh wrote an article in which she discussed the many dimensions of white privilege. She described it this way. She said, "It's like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks." In a little bit, I'll talk to Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead from Loyola University, Maryland, about the work she does with students to recognize and combat structural and personal racism. But first, a conversation with two women who work with Baltimore Racial Justice Action. That's a network of people who work to create racial equity. They offer training, coaching, and assistance to individuals and organizations, and they divide their work between training offered to white people and training offered to people of color. Dottie Burke Markowitz is a co-founder of Baltimore Racial Justice Action, who leads training sessions, and Laura Stoley Schmidt is an apprentice facilitator who is a former participant in the training program. Welcome to you both. And Dottie, let me start with you. How do you define white privilege, and what is the substance of the topic you take up in these training sessions?
I'm getting ready to move, and I came across in my files a cartoon that I think is the best explanation of white privilege that I can think of. In each frame is a white man and a black woman, in obviously in an office, in a workplace. And he says to her, "How does it feel to know that you got your job because of your race and gender?" And there's a silent frame. And then she says, "You tell me." And I think that's the best summary of white privilege, the fact that, you know, people can complain about affirmative action as special privileges, special access, when in truth the history of our country is of privilege that's granted because of white skin, and yet being oblivious to the fact that for generations there's been that special access, exclusive access and exclusive right to jobs, homes, all kinds of resources in this country. That changed only about 50 years ago, and the remnants of that privilege are still very, very much with us, as well as the fact that most people are oblivious of having it if we're white.
Laura Stoley-Schmidt, would you count yourself among those people who were perhaps oblivious to the notion that you had white privilege?
My awareness of having white privilege came really slowly, and about 4 years ago, doing some research for a class in graduate school, I started reading more about white privilege and some of the legacy of the benefits that people who are white have, like, for instance, accumulated wealth through generations. You know, my grandfather was able to buy a home because of the GI Bill. He was able to save money because of being able to buy that home. My grandparents got a nicer home that appreciated, and they continued to be able to buy a home wherever they wanted that would appreciate. And that gave them stability to save money in other ways, which now has made a financial safety net for me that some of my peers don't have. And it's because I'm white, because people of color, especially African Americans, were excluded from those benefits. I started to learn these things that kind of shocked me. Like, really? I have special privileges because I'm white? And it's a hard idea to get used to.
So there seems to me, Dottie, that there are a couple of levels of this. One of the levels is structural, those things that are sort of societal, perhaps even written into policies and laws. But then there's the personal level, too, people's hearts and minds. In this, in the work that you're doing with the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, are you attempting to address both of those levels? Or it seems to me that you're addressing things on a personal level because you've got individuals sort of signing up to take the course. How does it work?
Well, actually, it's quite the opposite. Our focus is very much on structural racism and how white privilege works to perpetuate structural racism. We do invite individuals to attend the class, but in the course of the class, each person decides on a place within their own sphere of influence where they want to apply the learning that they take from the class, so that the focus is constantly on how white privilege and racism are embedded in every institution and in every systemic part of our culture. So that's something we try to make clear to people coming in, although they don't necessarily understand what that means, because we're so conditioned to think about racism as an individual bigotry kind of issue.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. Dottie Burke Markowitz is a co-founder of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action. She's here in the studio along with Laura Stoley-Schmidt, who's an apprentice facilitator and has been a participant in some of the BRJA's training sessions. So, Laura, I'm interested that the work of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action is quite purposefully divided between training for Black people or people of color and people white people. Why is that?
I want to send this over to Dottie a little bit, because she was there from the beginning and helped set up that structure. So I'll just kind of give a personal perspective on it. When I have been to education events where there are white people and people of color who are learning some of the really painful things that were left out of our school education about the history of this country and then the legacy of advantages that have been inequally distributed, white people can sometimes, and I myself have experienced this, I can feel really guilty, angry, defensive, I want to ignore it. I go through a whole range of emotions that when I'm sitting in that group and being used to sort of having the privilege of expressing myself in any group because of my education and my experience, that I can end up really burdening the people of color in that room who may have to spend a lot of time listening to me discovering things they have always known and that I've had the privilege to not know. So it gives people the space to do the work that they really need to do.
Like Laura said, to deepen our understanding, particularly for us white folks, of our own role, even when we don't see ourselves as racist or bigoted, our own role in our own place in maintaining a system that we were born into for no fault of our own. There are other spaces that we have where we do interact across race, as well as each month, on the 13th of every month, we have an event where everyone is invited and where we look at some issue through a racial lens. Tonight, we'll be talking about mental health and race.
Laura, do these sessions lead inevitably to a consensus about what the remedies are for this? How does one get rid of structural racism in a society? Has it been your experience as a participant in this that you come out of this experience saying, okay, now I know what to do?
I wish. I feel like I've come out of it with a toolkit that helps me know what to do in terms of relationships with other people who are doing the work. I think a lot of times we want to, quote, like fix a problem by analyzing it, knowing the answer, and then fix it. And these problems have existed for 500 years in our country, and the solutions have to be collaborative and usually take some time.
Dottie Burke Markowitz, let's also talk a little bit about the implications of gender, age, and the other things that contribute to inequality besides race. Are these also topics of conversation in your training sessions?
We discuss and examine racism and white privilege in the context of a broader, what we call anti-oppression approach to education, which is an approach that recognizes that there are different categories of oppression and privilege, and that we can't ever really separate them. I mean, I'm a white person, I'm also a woman, so I've experienced sexism. So we welcome into the conversation those connections and how different categories can affect our understanding of racism and white privilege. But we are very intent on keeping the focus, the central focus, on racial justice and racial equity.
Well, Dottie Burke Markowitz and Laura Stoley-Schmidt, thank you both so much for coming by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Dottie Burt Markowitz is a co-founder of Baltimore Racial Justice Action, who leads training sessions. And Laura Stoley Schmidt is an apprentice facilitator who is a former participant in a training program. The next workshop for white people starts on Sunday, October 6th, runs for 6 weeks. The registration deadline is September 22nd. We've got information on our website, linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, you're listening to The Lines Between Us. We turn now to Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead. She's an assistant professor at Loyola University, Maryland, in the communication department. Her work focuses on the intersections between race, class, and gender. Kay, it's always good to see you. Thanks for coming back.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So you teach a class, much like, I suppose, the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, the folks we were just talking to, but you teach a class at Loyola University, Maryland, called Stereotypes in
U.S. Film and Television. Yeah. I actually developed this course for my work at Loyola because I wanted to have an opportunity to introduce my students to this intersection between race, class, and gender, these unspoken norms that we don't usually talk about over private and public conversations. But I felt that my students needed to be challenged to look beyond themselves at these points of tension that may not exist in their own personal lives, but definitely exist in the greater society.
So when we talk about the notion of white privilege, it is inextricably linked also to class as well, is it?
Yes.
Or is it not?
Well, it's also linked to gender. I mean, we talk about white privilege, and we know that it's a set of societal privileges that are spoken and unspoken. It's benefits that you did not earn, but you were, in effect, born into these privileges. So the fact that you have white skin, you get privilege based upon that, but you did not choose to be white. You were born white. You get privilege based upon the fact that you were a male, because we talk about male privilege. We talk about what the center is. There's some ideas that we have around what's considered to be the norm. If you're white or if you're male, able-bodied, Judeo-Christian, heterosexual, upper middle class, or landowners is what we used to call them, that's the norm. And anything outside of that is decentered. It's considered to be the other.
For people of privilege to be less dominant in society, does that mean, which is, and the corollary to that is for people who don't have privilege, for them to gain privilege, is it necessary for the people who currently have privilege to lose some? Is it a zero-sum game?
I'm not sure if it's a zero-sum game. I think it's very difficult to figure out how to balance privilege, because if you have privilege, who wants to give up privilege? Because sometimes you don't even know that you have it. There's a foundational article in the field by Peggy McIntosh, Unpacking the Backpack of Privilege. And one of the exercises that I have my students do early in the semester is I have them unpack their backpack. What type of privilege do you have? Let's lay it out on the table. Open it up and tell me what it is. Do you have a privilege where you're white, where if you walk into a store, the assumption is that you're not going to steal so you won't be followed? But if I walk into a store because I have brown skin, the assumption is I am taking something so I will be followed. That's that idea of privilege. How do you give that up?
You wrote a blog post that said that you found that your students have a harder time talking about class than they do about race and even about gender. Why is class, as difficult as conversations about race can be, why is it your experience that conversations about class are even harder?
We're used to talking about whether racism exists, whether or not we're post-racial. We're used to talking about the civil rights movement. We're used to talking about Dr. King. That's part of our society. It's part of what's being taught in history classes. It's easy to talk about gender. We're talking about males and females. We're talking about how we treat women, how women respond to men. I think that's easier and it's more accepted. This idea of class, I think, is one of those unspoken points of tension that's beneath the surface of America. It really drives our country, and nobody wants to talk about it because it means you have to give up something. If you want to bring people to the same level, something has to be given up. I think one of the ways I have my students get to this is I send them out to do a photography project. I say, I want you to walk around Loyola's beautiful campus, and it is absolutely gorgeous. And I want you to photograph any points of privilege that you see, whether it's the Starbucks coffee in the middle of the campus or the green space where you can lay out and you can play Frisbee. I want you to photograph those. And then let's come back and let's talk about it. And I remember one of my students 1 year said to me, I found a place where there is no privilege on campus. And he showed me a photograph of a parking lot. He said, look, we have old cars here. We have minivans here. We don't have that much privilege as Loyola students. And I said, actually, that's the faculty parking lot. It's not your parking lot. Go to where you see the BMWs. Go to where you see the Volvos and the Benzes. And I'm more than certain that you're probably in the student parking lot. Loyola is a very expensive university, and sure. They are aware of that. And I think by having them take photographs, they begin to see that they're living in a lap of privilege just by the fact that they can attend this school.
Do you expect that the notion of white privilege and the predominance of white privilege will change in 20, 30 years when most folks estimate that by about 2040 or so, white people will not be the majority race in the United States?
My students and I have been talking about this all week. When will things change? When will we actually be post-racial? And I told them I feel that we are sometimes like the children of Israel. We're roaming around in the desert and we're waiting for all the old people to drop dead. And then once they do, then we can be post-racial. But we begin to look at the steps of the dimensions of multiculturalism. And my students and I begin to realize that perhaps even though the color, the racial makeup of the world will change by 2040, the ideas that we have about people, the stereotypes and the misconceptions won't. It doesn't mean that in 2040, when we wake up, those in power will be brown people. That's not going to change. It's about who holds the power and essentially who makes the policies and the practices and the laws that drive our country. That is not going to change just because the racial makeup changes. Because race and power have to be tied to class. Because you're only making policy when you have money, if you're able to get lobbyists to work on your behalf. You're running for office because you have a lot of money behind you. Even if you personally don't have money, there are people willing to fund you to get you into that position. That won't change. And for things to really change around race and around class, then those things need to change.
When you walk your students through this study and appreciation of what white privilege is, tell us how you do that. How do you bring them to understand what the most important dimensions of this are for them to understand?
Well, for my students, when they come into my classroom, I have a sense on that first day that they are a little bit nervous, that they're looking to talk about race, class, and gender to a professor who is an African-American woman. So two of the issues they know that I already represent. The first thing I try to do is to encourage and create a safe space, that you don't have to believe the same thing that I do, but you have to be willing to listen. You have to have an open mind. We have to have an open and free space to say what we really feel. Now, what you feel might offend me, but I want to give you the space to say it because I can't address it unless you say it. If you say all the right things and never change, and you're not having the right experience in my classroom. So I begin by having them do this. I also have them create what I call these Raycloge journals. And Raycloge is just a combination of the first two letters from the word race and from class and from gender. And I told them that I want them to begin to record what I term diversity moments. That are the points during your day when you say something either to a friend or you hear someone say something or you think something that goes against what we're trying to do in this class. We want to get beyond these stereotypes. And I tell them that it's messy work. It's not easy. It's very, very difficult to change your values. It's very difficult to begin to see people differently. We have a term that we always use. We say, where'd you get that from? I believe that African-American people don't work as hard as we do. Where'd you get that from? I believe that, you know, Hispanics don't belong in the class. Where'd you get that from? Let's figure out where you got it from. And more than likely, you got it from somebody in your environment, a parent or a grandparent. There's been some knowledge construction that's been taking place. Let's get to the heart of that. What we're really asking for, people say post-racial, but what I think they mean is having a society where there's a table that everybody is welcome. All voices are encouraged. Differences are something that's supported.
Well, K-Wise Whitehead, this table in this studio is one that you are invited to anytime you feel like
Thank you.
Good to see you, and we look forward to the next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you again.
Dr. K-Wise Whitehead is an assistant professor of communication and African and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. We've got links to her blog and more about her work on our website for this series. Come to linesbetweenus.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts about privilege, race, class, and gender. What are the ways in which you experience privilege or the lack of privilege? Let us know by coming to linesbetweenus.org and sharing your ideas. After a break, Sheila talks about the growing levels of poverty in suburban areas. On 88.1, it's The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Morning's The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to our series on regional inequality, The Lines Between Us. Much of our coverage has focused on the city of Baltimore, which has a poverty rate three times that of the surrounding suburbs. But new data released over the past few years shows we should look closely at suburban poverty as well. Elizabeth Kneebone is a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program and co-author of Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. When I talked to her in January 2010, shortly after Brookings released a landmark analysis of suburban poverty data, she said in this region, they saw two diverging trends.
Overall, within the major metropolitan areas of the country, we've seen poverty increase in both cities and suburbs, but it's growing at a much faster rate in the suburbs. And what we've seen in the Baltimore region, first of all in the city, is slightly working against that trend, in that the Baltimore City experienced a significant decline in both the number of people living in poverty and in the overall poverty rate.
Indeed, in 2008, Baltimore City had 24,000 fewer residents in poverty than it did in 2000.
On the other hand, the suburbs, while the poverty rate held steady over this period, actually saw the number of poor people increase by over 20,000 between 2000 and 2008. What we found in this study really does highlight a shift in the geography of American poverty.
For the first time, there are more poor people in the Baltimore suburbs than there are in the city, mirroring a flip across the country. The contours of the urban safety net are well known, and many of the urban poor know how to access that safety net. But what about the suburban safety net? Scott Allard is the author of Out of Reach, Place, Poverty, and the New American Welfare State. And he joins us from the University of Chicago, where he's an associate professor in the School of Social Service Administration. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And in the studio with me is Peter Sabonis, Work with Dignity Program Director at the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Peter, the last time we talked in 2010, you were with Maryland Legal Aid, and you've had some personal experiences with the suburban safety net since then. Tell us what happened.
That's right. At that time, I talked to you about food stamp processing issues. And at that time, I was working with folks in the city and actually across the state accessing public benefits as an attorney with a program that devotes its services to those of low income. So I was pretty familiar with the public assistance system. What happened was I was laid off in 2011 and spent 6 months looking for work and had to, as everyone does, meet our household expenses. So what I did was I looked for the safety net.
And you were looking from Carroll County.
In Carroll County. So what I did was essentially I applied for the programs that I knew I was eligible for, and that was unemployment insurance, food stamps, and MCHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program.
For your son.
For my son. So I got unemployment insurance benefits. That's roughly 40% of your earnings, but there's a cap on it, and the cap for me made it so that I was getting about 25% of my earnings. There's no way I can make our mortgage payment, et cetera. I applied for food stamps.
And how did you feel this whole process of accessing the safety net worked in Carroll County?
Well, I felt that given my experience in Baltimore City, where I had accompanied lots of folks through this process.
As an advocate,
and actually sat in on these interviews, that it was quite different in Carroll County. In Baltimore City, we had very crowded waiting rooms. You could spend half a day there. The workers oftentimes were very stressed, overworked, et cetera. In Carroll County, I found just the opposite. I found a system that wasn't overwhelmed. I found a system that there were very few people in the waiting room. I had a scheduled time to be there. When I was there, there were probably only two or three others there. I found a worker who was professional, but friendly and helpful.
Let me pull Scott in here, because Peter's story is a little surprising. I mean, it would be easy to think that suburban caseloads might have gotten overwhelmed. As he said, Carroll County wasn't, but one might think that caseloads had gotten out of hand over the past decade with the rise in suburban poverty. Is the safety net really better in the suburbs now?
When we think about the safety net, it's important for us to think about the different components. There are public benefits programs like food stamps or Medicaid or MCHIP in the case of Maryland that are either largely federally funded or funded jointly between the federal government and the state government. And, you know, there are eligibility offices in all counties. Another important component to our safety net, however, are the nonprofit social service organizations. Organizations like legal aid groups, frankly, like, you know, the organizations Peter works for, provide the glue in our safety net. They provide a lot of direct services to help families grab the next rung on the ladder, help address barriers to employment, maybe provide programming for children. They also help connect people to the public safety net, again, much like Peter has done in his work. The difference is that our investment over the last 50 years has been on making those kinds of services more available in cities than in suburbs. And today, if you go into many suburban communities, you'll find either very few or in some cases no nonprofit human service organizations that deliver some of the most critical types of assistance for working poor families today.
On WIPR, this is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, talking about suburban poverty with Scott Allard, an associate professor in the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, and Peter Sabonis of the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. You know, one way to look for holes in the suburban safety net is to ask how quickly county social services offices are processing applications for food stamps and other benefits. In December 2009, the Maryland Department of Human Resources found itself under a court injunction to speed up its processing. That's part of what we talked to you about, Peter. And thanks to a suit that the Public Justice Center in Baltimore helped file, the judge gave DHR a year to start processing at least 96% of applications on time. Public Justice Center Legal Director Deb Gardner told us this week on time means within 30 days of the date the application was filed.
They were doing that only in, you know, 60 or 70 or 80% of the cases, and that had been, you know, getting steadily worse and worse. By November 2010, 1 month early under the injunction, the agency had reached that level of absolute compliance, and they have been able to maintain that and process at least 96%, and often they're at 98%, 98.9%. They've maintained a very high standard for several years now.
But Gardner says that success is fragile. Not everyone who's eligible for food stamps applied for them.
I don't say this to criticize the agency at all. They'd have another real challenge on their hands, though, if everyone who was eligible was actually applying. And there certainly has been a very significant increase in the number of people who are eligible. People are staying in poverty longer and staying unemployed longer.
Scott, this makes it sound like suburban agencies are catching up, but that there's something like a time bomb lurking out there. Is that how you see it across the country?
Well, I think we should appreciate some of the successes that our safety net has. Often we do this in academia and in our policy debates. We often focus on what's not working. And I think it's really important to realize how much the safety net expanded to address rising need. And it might not have done it as an ideal fashion as we'd like. But there's still some success there. And I think you see this in the increases in the SNAP caseloads in this example. There's still a number of reasons why people aren't enrolling in programs like SNAP. Some of it is that they may not be aware they're eligible. They may not be able to get to an office to apply for assistance. They may be right on the income cutoffs, and so you may be eligible, but only for a small amount. And so maybe applying for a modest monthly benefit might not be worth the time and effort, especially if you think you're going to get a job in the next few months. I think when we want to consider what the long-term prospects are for the safety net, again, I want to point us back to the nonprofit sector, because federal funding often will expand or contract to address rising need, but in suburban counties in the last decade, the median nonprofit human service expenditure per poor person has actually fallen from about $170 per poor person to less than $150. And that's in nominal dollars. So if we actually adjust it for inflation, it's an even more significant drop. And what that tells me is that there are fewer dollars to go around, but we know there are more people to help. And we know that this trend in rising suburban poverty isn't a temporary blip. This is going to be with us for some time. And so if we encounter another economic slowdown in the next few years, you could imagine suburbs being really ill-equipped to handle a greater number of people seeking help. And I think that's really where I have concerns, is where we are in our nonprofit and philanthropic communities.
Are we reaching a point where we're going to say that more of this problem should fall on government and expect less from charity?
One of the challenges of addressing poverty in suburban communities is there's this perception gap where we think, largely due to the kind of spatial discourse of poverty and some of the cultural myths about poverty, that poverty is an urban phenomenon exclusively. It's something that you see in Baltimore City, but you don't see it out in the suburbs. But that's not true. It's never really been true. But what that means is often people volunteer or give to organizations that are in the city. And it makes it hard for organizations in outlying areas to raise money, to supplement their government grants and contracts, or to fill in gaps when funding is cut. In the same way, foundations are often limited to where they can make grants, limited to the boundaries of cities or urban counties. And that also makes a big difference, because they can't seed new organizations or help cultivate promising new programs outside of our cities.
Is there any way to really address the situation for the suburban poor when the transportation networks are so fragmented in the suburbs?
Sure, there's a way to address that. And departments are trying to do that through online applications. I applied for unemployment insurance through a telephone system. Never dealt with any person face-to-face. That was there are problems with that at times, but it was relatively easy and streamlined for me. I didn't have to drive anywhere. You can develop systems that are accessible and streamlined. I mean, that can be an issue for archaic delivery systems, and they're going to stay archaic if we don't put public investment into them.
We have to keep in mind kind of the broader landscape of economic opportunity in our country. And one of the challenges moving forward, I mean, if you think there's a time bomb moving forward, to use your term, Sheila, one of the real kind of daunting prospects for our country is the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, or growing income inequality. And what this means is that there are going to be many more families who may not be poor this year, but may be vulnerable to falling into poverty, and our safety net needs to be able to respond to that. The other point that he raised, actually, that I thought was really interesting, was this notion about online applications, because it's become really prevalent. They're really important to processing many public benefits programs, and you can get your food stamps on an EBT card now, as opposed to actually getting kind of checks or stamps like you might have got back in the day. But you can't actually apply for everything online. You can't receive all help online, right? You can't always receive the counseling or treatment you need virtually. And so, being able to get from here to there in suburbs or in cities is really critical, and public investment in transportation has to be part of the solution. To that point, I think communities are getting really creative. I know that some of the more innovative programs to help address suburban poverty that I've seen have been in public libraries in suburbs, where they are providing kiosks and supports to help people access online applications, to help provide a computer literacy training, to help translate things for people who are not native English speakers. And, there are innovations out there that help us kind of narrow the gap, even when transportation isn't readily available.
Well, I'm grateful to you both for talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Allard is the author of Out of Reach, Place, Poverty, and the New American Welfare State. He's an associate professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. Peter Sabonis is the Work and Dignity Program Director at the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. We've got more information on our website, linesbetweenus.org, including previous Maryland Morning interviews about social services and poverty in the Baltimore suburbs. More of this interview there, too. On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for being with us this morning. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.